Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together, we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to Episode 7 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This show is airing on Monday, December 26th, 2016. I'm really glad you can join me once again for the show. Welcome back. And if you are a new listener, welcome for the very first time. Now, first off, I want to say thank you to the many people who have written and left voice memos, some just to say hi. This is your show, so I welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can always reach me directly by writing to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Or call the voicemail line. I'll give that number out at the end of the show. You will be pleased to know that the show is taking off. We're getting lots of new listeners every month. After 6 episodes, Citizens Climate Education has asked me to commit to at least 12 more episodes, so lots ahead in 2017. Now, I definitely could use your help, though, to get the word out about our program. If you like the creative and encouraging approach we take, please rate and review the show over on iTunes, if that's how you listen. This will make us more visible to new listeners looking for shows like ours. Also, share the show through Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you do your social networking. Thanks. On today's show, poet and environmentalist Lilis Mellon-Guignard returns to the Art House, this time with a poem about greener winters. Also, as always, I share your answers to the Citizens Climate Puzzler. This one about the new Trump administration, and I reveal the new puzzler question. But first, I sit down and speak with a college student who, like me and you, is passionate about climate communication. She has advice for us as we communicate our concerns with family, friends, and leaders. Meet Chandler Green. Chandler is a graduate student at American University researching strategic communications. She's also actively involved in the Put a Price on It campaign. We talk climate communications, what is working, what's new, and how to engage those who are not yet on board. People struggle with climate change. A lot of people don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And there's a recent study from Yale that says that even people who are concerned about climate change are not talking to their family and friends. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so you're referring to the climate silence.
The spiral of climate silence.
Yeah. And that was very apparent in this election. I mean, climate change rarely came up. And I think one of the big problems is there's two problems. There's a psychological issue, and people don't perceive climate change as really personally affecting them. And then there's the partisan divide. You know, if you're a Republican and you speak out about climate change, you're kind of going against your party. People are really scared to talk about climate change, depending on your political ideology.
And what are you discovering in your own research and your studies as a master's student?
I am studying strategic communication, and I'm focusing on climate change. How do we improve climate change communication? And I'm actually working on a theory paper looking into how you communicate social norms regarding climate change. A lot of research has focused on framing. Let's make an argument about climate change from a public health frame. Like, if we act on climate change, it's going to make us healthier, we're going to have less pollutants in the air, that sort of thing. What I'm looking at is, how do we communicate that most people care about climate change? How do we overcome the silence? One of the big messaging techniques is to say over half of Republicans and Democrats, both of them, you know, regardless of party, support renewable energy research. Over half of Republicans and Democrats support regulating CO2 as a pollutant. Those are the kind of messages that I'm looking into, and I haven't finished my paper yet, so I can't tell you if it is truly more effective than framing, but I think overall we need to try as many different strategies as possible.
So what do you think has been effective the past, you know, 3 or 4 years in getting people curious and engaged?
I think one of the biggest things, and especially moving forward, is finding powerful messengers. And I think one of the most powerful messengers really is any Republican. I mean, because that's, and I don't want to, and I don't say that as in a mean way, but I think it's just, it's really, it goes against the norm for someone on the other side to come out and to say, you know, yes, I am a conservative. I identify with this party, but I recognize climate change as a real threat. And I think part of a way to overcome that is really making an economic argument for climate change, which of course plays into the Put a Price on It campaign. We need to regulate CO2 as a pollutant.
Some people may react to that because they say, well, that's a very conservative approach. Mm-hmm. How can you get progressives and liberals on board with Put a Price on It?
I think it's easier to get progressives on board because they already have very strong pro-environmental beliefs. They already want to do something. The great thing about Put a Price on It, I think, is that it really is bipartisan. So we're going to address climate change, but it can also solve what's currently a market failure, and that CO2 has all these social costs that aren't accounted for. So it's polluting our air, it's polluting our water. We have these impacts from climate change. We as a society are picking up the tab for those costs. So we can really look at both parties and say, this is a solution that addresses a long-term problem and a short-term problem in terms of the costs that it's imposing right now.
So what I think I'm hearing more and more from climate communication experts like you is that we need to talk about climate change, but not necessarily say the words climate change.
Yeah, that's something I struggle with as well, because I think a lot of times when you come out front and you say climate change, people kind of close their ears and it's like, this seems like it's coming from the left. And so I think moving forward, and especially in these next 4 years, we have to find a way to talk about this issue in the most neutral and bipartisan way as possible. And, you know, it's going to be hard for me because, of course, I want to begin my conversation with climate change. But I think we need to begin our conversation with, this is our future. We want a healthy and prosperous future. And this is what we're going to have to do to ensure that.
Lots of people listen who are trying to find that silver bullet. Like, what's the one thing I can say that will get people engaged? And I think for too long, we've wasted a lot of our time trying to convince doubters, trying to convert people to believe something. And I think that there are so many people who actually say they are concerned about climate change, but they're really not doing anything about it. So to hit that audience, the ones who, yeah, climate change is really happening, it's a problem, it's terrible, how do you get them to the next step?
There are ways to act on climate change where you don't have to make what I think many people consider personal sacrifices. So much of messaging is directed towards, okay, these are the individual actions you can take. You can eat less red meat, like you should buy a hybrid. And I think people look at that as, well, that's a personal sacrifice. Like, yes, I care about our future and I care about climate, but like, I don't want to give that up. So we have to instill this belief that if we take collective action, that it will have an outcome. And so I think the biggest thing that we can do, and it's absolutely a challenge, is to get people to talk to their congressmen, talk to their representatives, try to get this grassroots support for policies. Like, I think that's the biggest thing moving forward. But I recognize that it's going to be a challenge to motivate people to do that.
What I love about your campaign is the title. It doesn't have climate in it. It doesn't have crisis. It doesn't have all those scary words. And it's a wonderful hashtag, Put a Price on mm-hmm. It. And I think it's very clever that that's what you all came up with, because I think it's something that will stick in people's heads and yeah. Definitely has the ability to spread.
Yeah, and the great thing is that it's attached with the show Years of Living Dangerously, which I think is a great communication tactic because it's all about storytelling. And they're not coming in and saying, oh my gosh, climate change is so scary. You know, so many narratives are like that. But they're taking sort of an investigative approach with, you know, come along on the story. Let's go see what's happening at the Great Barrier Reef. Let's go see what's happening in the American heartland. And then they're not only giving you these stories, but they're also giving you the solution with Put a Price on It.
And they do a third thing. They have a celebrity involved.
Yes.
Because we are so celebrity obsessed.
Yes.
It's like, oh, I don't know. Oh, wait, so-and-so's on it. Oh,
yeah, David Letterman? What? Yeah, like,
what words of wisdom or encouragement do you have for people who are concerned, but suddenly because of the outcome of the election, they feel defeated before they even go any further. Mm-hmm. What do you got for them?
Yeah, well, I say I absolutely feel for them. I'm in the same place, but what's giving me strength is the younger generation, my generation of millennials. I think that across the board, we identify with social issues and environmental issues, and we want to do something. We're not as divided as the current parties that are in office right now. So really look to young people and really try to unify the people around you. We have to work across these party lines to get anything done. This can't be just a Democrat liberal issue.
Preach. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'm really grateful that I got to speak with Chandler Green. Now, Chandler makes it clear conservative people who are dismissive or doubtful of climate change need to hear from their own. And that means in the USA, Republican climate leaders need to stand up and voice their concerns about carbon pollution and its negative effects. Well, good news, that has actually been happening. Over a year ago now, a group of 12 Republican members of Congress signed on to the Gibson Resolution. As of this date, that number has grown to at least 15. And the resolution will be reintroduced in the 2017 Congress. Now, what's brilliant about this historic document, and it is historic, is that it uses conservative language and values to press the moral case to address carbon pollution that causes danger to all our lives and livelihoods. So I've asked Elke Arneson, a millennial, on a gap year to work on climate solutions, to read for us the Gibson Resolution so that you can hear it for yourself. It's good news.
Resolution. Expressing the commitment of the House of Representatives to conservative environmental stewardship. Whereas it is a conservative principle to protect, conserve, and be good stewards of our environment, responsibly plan for all market factors, and base our policy decisions in science and quantifiable facts on the ground. Whereas prudent, fact-based stewardship of our economy and our environment is a critical responsibility for all Americans in order to ensure that we preserve our great nation for future generations. Whereas there has been a marked increase in extreme weather events across the United States, including more frequent heat waves, extreme precipitation, wildfires, and water scarcity. Whereas this has had noticeable negative impacts that are expected to worsen in every region of the United States and its territories, including, among other significant weather events and environmental disruptions, longer and hotter heat waves, more severe storms, worsening flood and drought cycles, growing invasive species and insect problems, threatened native plant and wildlife populations, rising sea levels, and, when combined with a lack of proper forest management, increased wildfire risk. Whereas, increased pollutants and other factors contribute to local, regional, and national environmental and human health impacts, including increased mercury in the fish we eat, elevated asthma attacks in our children, acid rain, smog, degraded water quality, urban heat islands, and rapid stormwater runoff that leads to costly infrastructure projects. Whereas, the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review states that the effects of a changing climate are threat multipliers that will aggravate stressors abroad such as poverty, environmental degradation, political instability, and social tensions. Whereas, if left unaddressed, the consequences of a changing climate have the potential to adversely impact all Americans, hitting vulnerable populations hardest, harming productivity in key economic sectors such as construction, agriculture, and tourism, saddling future generations with costly economic and environmental burdens, and imposing additional costs on state and federal budgets that will further add to the long-term fiscal challenges that we faced as a nation. Whereas any efforts to mitigate the risks of, prepare for, or otherwise address our changing climate and its effects should not constrain the United States economy, especially in regards to global competitiveness. And whereas there is increasing recognition that we can and must take meaningful and responsible action now to address this issue. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the House of Representatives commits to working constructively using our tradition of American ingenuity, innovation, and exceptionalism to create and support economically viable and broadly supportive private and public solutions to study and address the causes and effects of measured changes to our global and regional climates, including mitigation efforts and efforts to balance human activities that have been found to have an impact.
Thank you, Elke, for reading the Gibson resolution. Although it may sound wonky with all that formal congressional language, what is brilliant about the resolution is that it gives conservatives a template to consider and talk about climate change in their own terms. And as Chandler Green reminds us, at least in the U.S., we need to have more and more Republicans speaking out about our changing climate. Chandler and Elke are part of a growing campus movement called Put a Price on It. You can find out more and connect with Tom Erb, the field organizer, by visiting theclimatesolution.com. That's theclimatesolution.com. On Twitter, look for hashtag Put a Price on It. Now it is time for the Art House. Joining us once again in the Art House is poet and environmentalist Lilis Mellon-Ginyard. In episode 2, Lilis shared with us the poem Darkness about raising children in the time of climate change. She is back with a poem about snow. Well, actually, the lack of snow. She starts by telling us about her poem, Evergreen, and about the role of the poet in the time of climate change.
I really think that art has a role in helping us continue to relate and also reconnect, because we're disconnected from nature. And we have to love this planet, and we have to love the fact that we are animals on a planet, and the amazing abundance and fragility and regenerative processes and everything, good and bad, about the planet. I think a lot about what's the poet's role in helping us imagine this. You know, if we can imagine we're in the future and a good future that's different, but good, looking back, then suddenly lots of things are possible. And I've been wondering, you know, so what's the poet's role? What's the poet's role? And also about faith, and we talk about forgiveness. So whether it's in terms of forgiving ourselves, if we're people of faith or secular, it's still about forgiveness if you're going to move on, not being paralyzed. So Evergreen appeared recently in Patterson Literary Review. It begins with an epigraph from a poem, Monday, by Billy Collins, which said, "And the poets are at their windows because it is their job for which they are paid nothing every Friday afternoon." Evergreen. The day after Christmas 2006, and nowhere in the lower 48 is below 30 degrees Fahrenheit, except, my husband reports, a spot in Maine. I can be upbeat. Children in northern climes with new bikes are out riding them, spinning circles and circles. But how can I ignore those tykes who stand on porches holding sleds, their hats in their hands? Really, it is not today that worries me, an unremarkable gray without threat or promise, same birds at the feeder. Neither does tomorrow, a word my son knows only means not now, but some vague future. How will any child believe in a jolly giver of gifts wearing a fur coat by a fire at the icy top of the world once the glaciers are puddles in our textbooks? Regardless, The poets will be at their windows finding new images. Maybe something a pretty shade of green to compare the sky to. Pretty if we can just divorce memory from emotion and approach the new dawn, whatever its color, with the heart of a child on Christmas Eve who, looking back, knows he could have let go of the cat's tail sooner, feels bad that she busted her brother's favorite train, yet hopes a larger forgiveness presides. Yes, we poets will always be at our windows, except when at our children's bedsides, singing, shushing, singing.
Thank you, Lilis Mellon-Guignard, for reading your poem, Evergreen. If you want to discover more of Lilis's writing, visit her blog, A Tent of One's Own, tentofonesown.com. No caps, no spaces, tentofonesown.com. She is currently writing a creative nonfiction book about women outdoors for Texas A&M Press. Also, check out her award-winning short book of poetry, Young at the Time of Letting Go, which is available through Evening Street Press. I hope you enjoyed the Art House section today. It's my favorite part of the program, I have to say. Send me your ideas for the Art House. I'm interested in writers, artists of all sorts, comics, slam poets, and more. Send your suggestions to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. And before we end our program, we have our Citizens Climate Puzzler. Last month's puzzler was about the Trump presidency. These days, when we mention we are climate advocates, people may laugh and say, ugh, nothing is going to happen for the next 4 years. We are back to coal and other fossil fuels. Might as well take up a new hobby. So what do you say? How do you respond? Well, I got a ton of responses to this one. I wish I could share them all. Peter Buckland of State College, Pennsylvania, left the following voice memo.
Since I'm a local elected official, I've been answering the question you asked this way. The federal government has never actually been in charge of our nation's energy use or its portfolio. Plain and simple, the U.S. doesn't have a government-controlled national energy strategy. It's got a whole bunch of little energy strategies, from households and small companies to states and mega corporations. And people can act on every single one of those levels to affect change. Now, right now, I'm an elected official in a municipality in Ferguson Township, Pennsylvania, and I'm focusing my efforts at that level. I'm serving my four-year term, and in 2017, we are rewriting our zoning, and it will include incentives for green buildings and infrastructure. We're getting proposals for a new public works building that will have to be LEED Gold. And finally, we will conduct a comprehensive assessment of all township-owned property for solar PV. Those three steps, those little steps, will lead to something greater. Now, I say that hope lives in action. And by acting with my board in my municipality for a lower carbon future, I'm fulfilling a promise to myself, the voters who elected me, to my son, and to this beautiful home that we call Earth.
So Peter encourages us to not despair or be paralyzed, but to act locally. David Spence, a doctor from Flagstaff, Arizona, advocates appealing to President Trump's deal-making nature. In David's voice memo, he explains that once other countries like Canada place a fee on carbon, U.S. exports may be slapped with tariffs. In order to compete in the world market, he advocates a carbon fee and dividend program for the USA.
It is a market-based solution which factors in the amount of carbon pollution by the type of energy and its carbon content. This gets the government out of the business of choosing winning and losing technologies and lets the market choose. Some economic functions are best left to each state to enact. However, a carbon fee and dividend must be a national program, since the fees are assessed at the mine, the wellhead, or the port of entry, which are all activities national by their nature. Congress will understand this and give the president a bill that he will sign in order to make America great again.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Peter. And thanks to everyone who responded to last month's puzzler. Now it is time for our new puzzler question. You were chatting with a neighbor and you mentioned your commitment to addressing carbon pollution because of the dangers it presents. Your neighbor, let's call her Lucinda, is genuinely confused. She says, "Wait, but back in school I learned how important carbon dioxide is for plants and photosynthesis. Our teacher said that without carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we couldn't survive." So, what do you say to Lucinda? I'm interested in your answers. Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact info, and where you are from. Get back to me by January 15th, 2017. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text or leave a voice memo of 3 minutes or less at 570-483-8194. Plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 570-483-8194. Thank you for listening to today's show. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Just look for us on iTunes. Search for Citizens Climate Lobby. You could also see us on Podbean and Stitcher Radio, and find us on Northern Spirit Radio. Just visit northernspiritradio.org. Join us for the ongoing discussion that we're having at our Facebook group. It's facebook.com/groups/Citizens Climate Radio. Feel free to call in and leave a voice memo. Give me your feedback. Tell me a success story you would like to share, or just say hi. That number again is 570-483-8194. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. We had audio technical assistance from Chris Palucci and Eric Scott at MediaVolution. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Keck, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use on the show is licensed, unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes one suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guests. An easy way to share the show is to get a link to it over at ccl.podbean.com. That's ccl.podbean.com. On the right, you will see Citizens Climate Radio listed under categories. That's ccl.podbean.com. Bean. Like bean bag. I'm running out of bean analogies. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.
Hello? Is anyone there? Hi, this is Elizabeth Jeremiah from the Elizabeth Jeremiah Global Worldwide Ministries in Jesus, and I am desperate to get onto this podcasting program. Could you please, on my behalf, lobby Peterson to allow me to come on? I think he is discriminating against me, and I simply cannot understand why, but I've got good news to share about generational curses and carbon dioxide and eco-feminist and all sorts of things, so let Peterson know that you want Elizabeth Jeremiah. You want her bad. Not in a bad way, though.